In that reading,
could you please then to ask our brother Paul to give us his thoughts on the development and destruction of the beast, his image and organisation, from Revelation chapter 12 to 14.
Evening, brothers and sisters. So we've got three chapters to look at this evening, quite a lot to try and cover, and we won't be able to go into a huge amount of detail, but hopefully by looking at these three chapters, looking at 12, 13 and 14, we're able to see a particular section of the book of Revelation where we see not only the history but also that which is to come, the hope of the coming kingdom and the vision of the Lamb upon Mount Zion. And in doing so, we're able to see the contrast between the falsehoods of the system of religion which was set up in history, compared with the truth of the kingdom to which we all look. We see a contrast between the establishment of Christendom, the kingdom of Christ on earth as it was thought to be, and the establishment of God's kingdom when Jesus does return to the earth, as is set out in the 14th chapter. We see the contrast between those who are not defiled with women, those who are the saints who have held to the truth, compared with the woman who has defiled herself and has become with child, having committed fornication with the world. And so we've got a lot to cover, but I think having these three chapters together does give us those contrasts. And I just want to start off by having a bit of an overview and having a look at these chapters in the context of the rest of the book of Revelation. And this is a copy of a chart by Brother Gates, which was done a long time ago now, but it does, I think, give us a very helpful picture of these chapters of Revelation. So if we look at the top, the numbers in red are the chapters of the book. So chapter 1, 2 and 3 contains the letters to the seven ecclesias. And over on the right, chapter 4 gives a vision of the kingdom, the door opened in heaven. And then chapters 5 to 7 give us the seals and the early history from the time the book of Revelation was written up to the sixth seal, the great earthquake at the time of Constantine, where there was that change of religion from paganism to so-called Christianity. And that series of chapters with the seals is then concluded with a picture of the white robed multitude, the picture of the saints in chapter 7. And then in chapters 8 and 9 we have the trumpets, which conclude with chapter 10, the picture of the rainbowed angel. And then in last week, I believe you got as far as chapter 11, where we've got the picture of the witnesses and that period of time of witnessing, which concluded with that picture at the end of chapter 11 of the seventh angel sounding. And it says at that time, in verse 15 of chapter 11, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. So this vision of the kingdom it concludes with. And now we come to chapter 12, and we don't continue on beyond that. We go back in time to look at this period of history through the prism of the beasts, based upon the beasts that are there illustrated right back in the time of Daniel in his prophecy in Daniel chapter 7. And so tonight's chapters, 12, 13 and 14, give chapters 12 and 13 the picture of the dragon, which we've read about, pagan dragon, and that becoming the Christian Roman power in chapter through chapter 12 into chapter 13, but then concluding in chapter 14 with the establishment of the kingdom, the Lamb upon Mount Zion with 144,000, and the reaping of the harvest vintage, the judgment of the world in order to establish the kingdom of God. And then the book then continues on with the vials in chapters 15 and 16. Again, moving on to the picture of the consummation of things and the establishment of the kingdom at the end of the book. So if we look at what we're going to be covering this evening then, chapters 12, 13 and 14, we start in chapter 12 at this time around the 300 AD, the time when in seals there had been the great earthquake in Revelation chapter 6. And so we're going to pick up from there, but we're going to look at it through the picture of the woman, the man-child, and the beast, and various descriptions of the dragon, the beast that came out of the sea, the beast that came out of the earth, the image of the beast. All of these things are going to be brought out in chapter 12 and chapter 13. So I think just to see that as a picture of where we're looking at within the book of Revelation is quite helpful, just to see those three chapters in that way. If we move on just to look then again at another overview slide, very familiar to us no doubt, the picture, the kingdom of men, Christadelphian teaching since 1848, and we start off with this picture back in Daniel, the image seen by Nebuchadnezzar, starting with Babylon, coming down through the legs of iron to that divided Roman Empire. And his picture then that goes on to Daniel chapter 7 with the beast, the lion, the bear, the winged leopard, and then the fourth beast. And then what it goes on to show is that the fourth beast is shown in greater detail in these chapters that we look at this evening. In Revelation chapter 12, the dragon, the Roman dragon, is pagan and then Christian under Constantine, 312 AD. And then chapter 13, we have this beast of the sea, Rome in its development from AD 493 up to AD 800, showing the eclipse of the imperial system and its rejuvenation in the Justinian epoch. And then the development from that, the beast of the earth and the image of the beast, the development of the Holy Roman Empire from around 800 AD. Which corresponds to the little horn seen in Daniel chapter 7 in that fourth beast. And then it concludes with the picture, the final manifestation of the kingdom of men at the end in Revelation 17, and that which is to be destroyed and the kingdom established. So tonight we're going to be looking then and focusing on that part at the bottom. These three elements, Revelation 12, the dragon, Revelation 13, the first part of the chapter, the beast of the sea, and then the latter part of Revelation 13, the beast of the earth and image of the beast. And then we'll go in to look briefly in chapter 14 to the judgments and the establishment of the kingdom. So having seen that very briefly, I think it's also worth just seeing how strong the foundations are. When we're trying to understand what we're reading about, when we come to Revelation chapter 12 and chapter 13, how do we know that we can be confident that we're looking and understanding these things in the right way? Well, I think that previous slide is very helpful. And this analysis that was in the book Revelation Witch Interpretation by Brother Graham Pearce is also very helpful, because it shows the distinct similarities that there are between the beasts as they're described in Daniel's fourth beast, and the beast that we're going to look at in chapter 12 and 13. If we're reading carefully this evening, as we read Revelation chapter 12, we've noticed that there was a description of this great red dragon, which had seven heads and ten horns. And we're told that it persecuted the saints, those who had the testimony of Christ. And it persecuted for a period of 1,260 days. Well, that has a very distinct correspondence and can be seen very much to be a description which comes out of Daniel chapter 7. We haven't got time to go back to Daniel tonight, but if we go back into Daniel chapter 7, that fourth beast is described as that beast, great and terrible fourth beast, but it has 10 horns, the same as the dragon in Revelation 12. It also persecutes the saints. It persecutes for a period which is defined, and we can understand as 1,260 years. And that beast, the beast in Daniel, continues until the coming of the kingdom of God. And so what we're looking at in chapters 12 and 13, as we look through these beasts, is something which was there at the time that John was writing down the words that he was given, but would continue right through until the time of the kingdom, and is going to be destroyed at the coming of Christ. So just while we've got the slide on, if we look at the beast of the sea, what we have in Revelation chapter 13, again we see that correspondence between them. There's a beast that's not described as a dragon, it's described as the beast that came out of the sea, but actually the characteristics are the same. It has 7 heads, it has 10 horns, it persecutes the saints, it persecutes for 1,260 years, and it blasphemes God, as we have in Daniel chapter 7, verse 8 and verse 25. And although the beast of the earth is a different description, it's got a beast just with 2 horns, nevertheless, it's described as a beast which persecutes the saints. And we're not looking at chapter 17 tonight, but we see that correspondence carries on right through to that scarlet-coloured beast in chapter 17 as well. So what we're looking at tonight is not something which comes out of nowhere when we read the book of Revelation. It's something which is rooted in what could be understood from understanding the book of Daniel, understanding the world empires from Babylon through to Rome. And what we have in Revelation is an expansion of that understanding with the detail of the history from the time of John at the end of the first century, looking through right to the time of Christ's return and the establishment of the kingdom. So, coming into chapter 12 then, this is what we're looking at first of all. Revelation 12, the Roman dragon, pagan, then Christian, under Constantine. And we've read through the chapter. This is a brief summary of what we have within the chapter. We're introduced first of all to a woman, a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars, and she being with child cried, travailing in birth and pained to be delivered. And so we have this pregnant woman described as a wonder in heaven in the first 2 verses. And then we had the great red dragon which was waiting for the child to be born. Verse 5, the birth of the man-child. And then in verse 6, the woman flees from the dragon. Then we've got that war in heaven between Michael and the dragon and the devil. And the chapter concludes with the persecution of that woman and the remnant of her seed by the serpent, the remnants of this dragon power. So, how do we understand then what's going on in this chapter? We've seen some initial indications going back to Daniel that we've got a beast which is a Roman beast. When we see a beast, the red dragon with 10 horns, one which persecutes the saints. What then does the woman represent? Well, the woman is a representation of a body of a religious body. And let's come back to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, where the Apostle Paul writes to the Corinthians, and his concern over the purity of the ecclesia there in the first century. And we see in this very much the language then that comes out in Revelation chapter 12. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 2, Paul says, I am jealous over you with godly jealousy, for I have espoused you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. So we're familiar with this analogy. The ecclesia is the bride of Christ and is to be presented to him as a chaste virgin, a pure woman who waited for the coming of the bridegroom. And that's how she's described when we get later on in Revelation to Revelation chapter 19. But Paul was concerned. Verse 3 says, but I fear lest by any means, as the serpent beguiled Eve through his subtlety, so your mind should be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. He was concerned that they would be beguiled, and that is what happened to the ecclesia. It became corrupted by the thinking of the flesh, and it became with child by that fornication with the things of the world, and took on itself the seed of the serpent. And so when we come to the picture in Revelation chapter 12, we see this woman who is seen as being in heaven, coming to a position of power and authority in that sense, but hasn't gone about it in the right way. That woman is with child. She's not a chaste virgin waiting for Christ the bridegroom to come. And so at that time in Revelation chapter 12, at the time of that birth of that man-child is about to come to pass, that the dragon is waiting to devour her, devour him. There's this conflict between the red pagan power, the pagan Roman imperial power, and this growing power of Christianity. A Christianity which has corrupted itself in order to get into power. And so this is the war then between the pagan Roman powers and Constantine. Constantine the Great, as he's known, one who became a champion for the Christians and enabled the change from paganism to pseudo-Christianity in the early years of the 4th century AD. We've seen the roots of the dragon in Daniel chapter 7. I want to just turn forward a few pages to Thessalonians to see the origins and the roots of the idea of this man-child that we see in verse 5 of Revelation 12. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, once again, the Apostle Paul writes of those things which were going to happen. It was a matter of prophecy that the ecclesia would be corrupted. And so we read in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 of this man of sin which is to be revealed. And Paul says in verse 3 of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. It was a matter of prophecy that there would be an apostasy, a falling away first, and the revelation of the man of sin. And that man of sin is the man-child who is described in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 5. It's the birth of this corrupt Christian power within the Roman Empire. What became the power of the papacy as the years rolled on. We see verse 4, the description of this son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And so the religious power that came to power in the Roman Empire was one which didn't follow the truth. It became an opposition to the truth. It was a falling away from the truth, opposing and exalted himself above all that is called God. And so in this 4th century, the early years of the 4th century AD, there was this tussle, the fight between Constantine and those who wanted to retain the Roman Empire as a pagan, worshipping the gods of pagan Rome. And let's come back then to Revelation 12 and just look at a couple of the verses within the chapter. You see in verse 3, there appeared another wonder in heaven, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, 7 crowns upon his heads. And we'll talk about those 7 heads when we get to chapter 13. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and he cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And in the history of this time, what happened was that as it came to a climax, the Roman Empire had three rulers within it. There was Constantine, there was Licinius, and there was Maximin, who was a pagan emperor over in the east of the Roman Empire. And he was defeated by Licinius. And this is what's described here in verse 4. His tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, a third of the Roman Empire. The stars fell at that time. And that left Constantine against Licinius. And that then is the battle which we get in verse 7. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels. But it was Michael, this man-child, which prevailed over the dragon. And so Licinius was defeated, and Constantine became the sole emperor of the Roman Empire, and he then championed the Christian cause. And we'll look at some of the history of that briefly in a moment. Before we get to that, though, let's just notice verse 6, where we have that time period. The woman fled into the wilderness, and there she hath a place prepared of God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. So what does this woman represent? We said it represented the religious order of things. It was the corrupted ecclesia, which had become the church and had gone after power. And then in verse 6, the woman flees into the wilderness. In the rest of Revelation, we've got a picture of two women, really, haven't we? We've got this bride that's ready for the bridegroom in Revelation chapter 19. And we've got the woman, the harlot, who is to be destroyed later on in the book. And this woman has elements of both of those things within it. The woman flees into the wilderness and suffers persecution. And we see that described later in the chapter, that the remnant of the woman's seed are described in verse 17, the last verse of the chapter. The dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And so in the remnant of the woman's seed, there were those who had the truth, those who keep the commandments of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. And so that small remnant are there, are the bride, which is pure at the end and is part of the bride of Christ. Even though what we're introduced to at the beginning of the chapter is this woman who's been corrupted. And so the woman flees into the wilderness. And this describes the way in which those who didn't accept the way that the Christians had taken on political power were then persecuted. And they fled from the centre of the Roman Empire to what's described as the wings of the empire, to the outskirts of the empire, very much out of the centre in Italy, out to North Africa and other parts of the Roman Empire, where they were able to find some respite from the persecution which they suffered. And that was to continue, we're told in verse 6, for a period of 1,260 days. And think of these time periods as periods of years, 1,260 years. And it's amazing how many of these there are when we start putting them together. This is a table which shows some of those periods. They're described in a different language, but they're all for a period of 1,260 days or years. So in Revelation 11 and 12, it's described in that way, 1,260 days. In verse 14 of chapter 12, it's described as time times and a half. In Revelation 11, verse 9, we've got 3 days and a half. It's a slightly different time period. But then 42 months, again, is 3.5 years or 1,260 days. And that has its origins right back in Daniel chapter 7, verse 25, where we have the description of that period as a time times and the dividing of time. And so we haven't got time to think about this in much detail tonight, but it's very interesting to note those time periods and to think that from the time of the rise of Christianity in around 312 AD, the time of Constantine, there was a period of 1,260 years of where the woman was there fed in the wilderness. And that period concluded with the persecution of the Christians, which came to its head in the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day in 1572. And there are other time periods we could consider. And as we're here standing in the year 2016, looking at the interpretation of Daniel chapter 7 and the period of the time, times and dividing of time, we think, well, where does that time period end? Where will when will the kingdom come? We're looking with Thomas at the 1260 years that went to 1572. There was another period from the rise of the papacy to become the bishop of the Bishop of Rome, to become the first amongst all the bishops in the papacy, and that has a period that ends in the French Revolution. And then there's another period which goes from when that power of the papacy was confirmed in 610, 1260 years takes us to 1870, when the papacy lost its power and was just a prisoner in the Vatican. But perhaps when we're looking at these time periods, there are also very significant events that we could look at. The rise of that power also had a particularly significant element at the time between 755 AD and 800 AD, which we'll look at shortly, when the Holy Roman Empire was established and Charlemagne became the first of the emperors of that Holy Roman Empire. And perhaps that's what's been described as the rise of that little horn in Daniel chapter 7, which would take us, depending on what date we take that from 755 to 2015, or 800 when he was crowned, up to 2060. Perhaps some dates to think about. But there we have in verse 6 then, that this idea that the woman would be fed and be preserved for 1,260 days. And it's amazing language, isn't it, when we see what the description is of this great earthquake, as it was described in Revelation chapter 6. The change from paganism to pseudo-Christianity is described in verse 7 here as Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. It's described in verse 10 as now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down. It was a massive change. It sounds like the establishment of the kingdom. But it wasn't, as the following verses and the chapter 13 shows. There was a long time still to go before the kingdom would come. But that change from paganism to a Christian empire was seen as a massive change at the time. And here's just a couple of quotations from a historian, Eusebius, who was writing at that time, at the time of Constantine, in his church history of by Eusebius in book 10. This is the sort of language he used. He says, "Sing unto the Lord a new song, for he hath done marvellous things. His right hand and his holy arm hath saved him. The Lord hath made known his salvation. His righteousness hath he revealed in the presence of the nations. And in accordance with the utterance which commands us to sing the new song, let us proceed to show that after those terrible and gloomy spectacles which we have described, which is the persecution of the Christians by the pagan emperors, we are now permitted to see and celebrate such things as many truly righteous men and martyrs of God before us desired to see upon earth and did not see, and to hear and did not hear." And so they're really celebrating this change, things which they had longed to see. And he goes on to talk about these far better things that had been that had happened. And in the words in yellow, he says, "Come and see the works of the Lord." He's quoting from a psalm and applying this to what was happening at the time. "Come and see the works of the Lord, the wonders which he hath done upon the earth. He hath removed wars from the ends of the world. He shall break the bow and snap the spear in sunder and shall burn the shields with fire." And he says, "Rejoicing in these things which have been clearly fulfilled in our day, let us proceed with our account." And so here was the establishment of Christendom, the kingdom of Christ upon earth. And this is what was seen as the church taking its place as the official religion of the Roman Empire. And so it was a huge change, a great earthquake, as it was is described in chapter 6. I'm going to move on into chapter 13. We've seen right through to the end of chapter 12 that persecution of the saints which was brought about. But in chapter 13 we come to the picture of these things continuing into another beast. We see that similar description in the first couple of verses. "I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy." And so again, the Roman beast, those characteristics which come out from Daniel chapter 7. But it's a beast that rises out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns. The picture of the dragon was of a dragon with seven heads, and the crowns were upon the heads. But this is a later development when those horns, the power, is no longer on the heads, but is on the crowns. And so within chapter 13, we haven't had it as a reading, but just to give an overview of the chapter, the first eight verses are this picture of the beast of the sea. Verses 9 and 10, we've got an exhortation to the saints. Verse 11 to 18 then, the beast of the earth, the image of the beast, the mark of the beast, and the number of his name. So let's just think then, first of all, about the beast. Verse 1 says, "I saw a beast rise up out of the sea." And just want to notes, we haven't got time to look at this in any detail, but we see that the Greek uses two different words for beast in the book of Revelation. One, which relates to the living creatures, which is in a reference to pictures which relate to the saints. So in chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, and chapter 14, if we look at chapter 14, verse 3, it says, they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And this is a picture of Christ and the saints at the time of the kingdom. Four beasts. But it's a different word. It's not the word that's used of the beast that we have in verse 1 of chapter 13. It's the Greek word zoon, and it relates to the living creatures. Whereas the word which we have in our chapter 13, the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth, and then in chapter 17, the scarlet coloured beast, is a different word in the Greek, the word therion. So just to note that, we're looking through and reading through this in the Authorised Version and reading about beasts. It's worth noting that there are different words that are used in relation to those different classes. So looking at chapter 13 and this beast of the sea, we're going to see in these first verses of the chapter that the beast of the sea, which is a picture of Rome in its development, from moving on from the time of Constantine, from 493 AD up to 800 AD. It shows the eclipse of the imperial system, emperors of Rome, and then the rejuvenation of that system in the time of Justinian, and then the rise of the papacy, giving of papal privileges. We saw in chapter 12 a description of the dragon that had seven heads, and this beast in verse 1 has seven heads. And there's an explanation later on in Revelation 17 about the seven heads of the scarlet coloured beast and the seven mountains on which the woman sits. But it's also described as seven kings in Revelation 17. It could be described as seven kingdoms or forms of government. And this is what Brother Thomas puts forward in Eureka. But it wasn't a new interpretation. This is just out of interest, really, an example. There's a writer on the book of Revelation called Thomas Pyle in 1795. And his interpretation also of this symbol of the seven heads uses the idea that it refers to seven forms of government which the Roman power went through. It's quite hard to read this. I tried to do it once before and I got stumbled with all the F's and S's when you look at this old writing. But it's commenting on the heads, which in Revelation 13, we have this description of the head in verse 3. I saw one of the heads, one of these seven heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wandered after the beast. And he talks about these heads, and he says, which is forms of government under which this empire has passed and is to pass. That is, the Roman power started with kings, and then it had consuls, second, and then decem viri, or 10 governors, and then tribunes, and then the fifth one was dictators, and then the sixth was the emperors, the Roman emperors, which started in the first century BC and continued through into the time of Constantine and beyond that to the time we come to here in Revelation 13. And within the verses here, it gives a description of what happens with the sixth head. So he says, there will follow another indeed, which is another head, which may be called the seventh. That is the reign of the Christian emperors. But this is to be a short one, for considered as truly Christian, it will be but a short one indeed. Primitive and pure Christianity being soon to be overrun with corrupt superfluitions. And if you take your reign at the longest, it lasted not more than 135 years. Or again thus, at the fall of the sixth head of the imperial Caesars, the Gothic kings, their conquerors, may be counted as the seventh head, or change of the Roman government. So it identifies the sixth head as the Caesars, the emperors of Rome, which was then superseded by the Gothic kings, which would be counted as the seventh head, or change of government. And he then goes on to see the development of that. And he says, when these conquerors are expelled, there arises an imperial power, that of Justinian, and afterward Charlemagne, who are to give temporal power and dominion to the church empire. Thus the sixth head may be said to live again and its deadly wound to be healed, which reviving head will be called the eighth in number, though really the same in kind with the sixth. So that's just another example of the interpretation of Revelation, which is pretty much consistent with what Christadelphians have been teaching for the last 150 years. This one goes back to 1795. So this beast of the sea, it's got seven heads and it's got 10 horns, and the crowns are no longer on the heads but are on the horns. And so this is talking about the same Roman power but in a later development, in the period after the seventh head, after that Gothic power has come and gone, when the barbarian kingdoms held their sway in the west. And so what happened was that the dragon, or that element of the Roman Empire, moved its power, and Constantine moved his centre from Rome to Istanbul, or Constantinople, as it was established there in the eastern part of the Roman Empire. And in the west, the Roman Empire was invaded by barbarian kingdoms, which became the Ten Horns. This is an illustration of the great number of barbarian migrations and kingdoms. This is dated AD 526, and we see the list of the names there: Vandals, Goths, Ostrogoths, Visigoths, Huns, Franks, and so on. They came into the area of the Roman Empire, they weakened the empire and became the rulers of it, and therefore it's described as having crowns upon the horns, these 10 horns of the barbarian kings who took over that western part of the Roman Empire. And that's what was happening from in those times, from the 400s AD up until the 700s AD, which is when we come to the beast of the earth. And if we just look through the verses, we see that exhortation in verse 9, if any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity, let him go into captivity. He that be killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. And I beheld another beast come up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, and spake as a dragon. Different beast that came out of the earth with 2 horns, but you see the description that it was like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. And so it had the elements of Christianity, the lamb, the true lamb, which we see in the early part of Revelation chapter 14 on Mount Zion, but yet it spake as a dragon. Inside, it was made of the thinking of the flesh and the dragon, the old serpent, the devil and Satan. What's this beast of the earth then? Well, the beast of the earth is really a symbolisation of that eighth head, the revival of the term emperor in the western part of the Roman Empire. The beast of the earth, in the image of the beast, developed in this time around 800 AD. It's the rise of the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. And what happened in history? The development of the Holy Roman Empire. On Christmas in the year 800, Pope Leo III crowned the Frankish King Charlemagne as emperor. And that was significant. He was called emperor. And by doing that, he revived the title emperor in the Western Europe after more than three centuries. And so this was the revival of that head, the sixth head revived. It came back to life again as an emperor, and it became the Holy Roman Empire. And we see in verse 13, concerning this beast that came out of the earth, he doeth great wonders, that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And Charlemagne, Holy Roman Emperor, had a great interest in expanding his territory and expanding the belief in Christianity. And it's quite difficult to pick out, but there's a map that shows the growth of the kingdom of Charlemagne. But just look at the text that it says at the top. Charlemagne cherished the principles of the Christian religion and the Church of St. Peter. The interests of the church and his own political interests were closely linked throughout his reign. His will to extend his power and to govern were inseparably connected with his purpose to spread out the Christian religion all over the world. He thought that he was personally responsible for the progress of God's kingdom on earth. We see that language again, which we saw in Revelation 12. This is the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth. And that was the mindset of Charlemagne, the first of the Holy Roman Emperors. So he was a political, military emperor, but he was supported by the Bishop of Rome, who became the Pope, the most important of the Catholic bishops. Charlemagne established his capital in Aachen, which is just inside Germany nowadays. And this is a picture inside the cathedral in Aachen. And we see the down the bottom here, funerary casket, and also another gold encrusted casket there. And when we come to verse 13 and we think about that description, he doeth great wonders. And verse 14, he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast. And this is just an example of that. This is the shrine to the Virgin at Aachen, in one of those caskets. It claims to have the shroud of the Virgin Mary, as well as the swaddling clothes worn by Jesus as an infant, the loincloth worn by him on the cross, and the cloth on which John the Baptist's head was laid after his beheading. These four great relics of Aachen are housed in one collective reliquary, the Shrine of the Virgin. It became a custom to show the four relics every 7 years, and that is still practiced. And there's another reliquary which is purported to have the belt of Jesus that it was before he was crucified, again in the same place. This is the deception of the church, which goes alongside it, the belief in the saints going to heaven and the creation of saints, which we'll mention again in a moment. What then about the image of the beast? It describes that in verse 14. He had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth, that they should make an image to the beast which had the power by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast. The image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. This is what Brother Thomas says about the image of the beast. The conflict between the crown and the mitre, that is between the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, and the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, two-horned symbol of the Romish hierarchy, the result of which was the triumph of the mitre, the papacy, over the crown, by which the hierarchy became independent of the secular order of the dominion. This sovereign and imperial hierarchy, capitalised by the dynasty of the popes and known commonly as the papacy, is the image of the beast. And so we've got the Holy Roman Empire, the emperors and the popes, but then later on we have the papacy growing in power to have its power to stand on its own two feet, as it were. And this is what happened in around 1080 AD. Around the time of this man, Pope Gregory the VII, he was Pope from 1073 till 1085. And he was actually made a saint, proclaimed to be a saint in the 1700s. But that conflict between the emperor and the pope came to a head in that time. The monarch, Henry IV of Germany, pretended to depose the pope, but Gregory excommunicated the emperor. And as a result, the emperor was powerless. His subjects wouldn't do what he told them to do. His Henry's subjects turned against him, and he was forced to come back to Gregory and ask for forgiveness. And here he is bowed before the Pope, having had to wait for 3 days in the snow before he was allowed to come in and see him. So this was the power of the papacy, what is described here as the image of the beast. It says in verse 16, "He causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive the mark in their right hand and their forehead, that they might not buy or sell, save he that had the mark and the name of the beast and the number of his name." And we could go into some of the history of the excesses of the papacy and the way that they used their power to prevent people from buying or selling if they didn't accept the Roman Catholic religion, and some of the history there, but we've run out of time to be able to look at that. He talks about the mark of the beast in this verse 17. He had the mark of the beast, the number of the beast, name of the beast, the number of his name. Mark in the right hand. And the Catholic priests, when they're ordained, are marked with the sign of the cross on their hand. The bishop anoints both the hands joined together in the form of a cross, and he makes with the right hand the sign of a cross upon the hand. And that's the making of a priest, the ordination of priests, as it was set out in that example 1627. And still today we see that mark of the beast being put on the foreheads of those who go to the church, christening on Ash Wednesday. And Brother Thomas makes a comment on that, but he says that the character or the mark, it states that the doctrine that if anyone shall speak against the sacraments of baptism, confirmation and ordination, that the mark should not be impressed on that soul. Let him be accursed. And the word character in ecclesiastical Latin is the equivalent to what we have in Revelation 13, the word mark. So interesting link there to the mark of the beast. And the chapter 13 concludes with the number of the beast, 666. And we've seen from the context, right, going back from Daniel, that this is a Roman power that's developed, became the Roman Catholic Church power. And it was a Latin power. Here in Eureka, Brother Thomas sets out the numerical value of the Greek letters of Latinos or Latin power, and shows that the numerical value comes to 666. It is a Latin power, but that wasn't just something which Christadelphians came up with. This is a book by Irenaeus in 180 AD in his book called Against Heresies, and he makes a comment there that the name Latinos has the number 666, and it's very probable that the last kingdom has this word, for they who now reign are Latini. And that Catholic Church was very much a user of the Latin language, and the Mass was there in Latin right through to the 1960s. And it's still, of course, known today as the Latin Church. This is just a picture of a page from Wikipedia. The Roman Catholic Church is known as the Latin Church. And so we have the powers to be brought to their knees by the work of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so in chapter 14, we have the picture of the Lamb, the saints on Mount Zion. We have the everlasting gospel being preached. And then the fall of Babylon in verse 8. And then the warnings of further judgment in verse 9 to 12. And the final vintage judgments which are poured out, are brought upon the world. And so what we see here is the contrast to those things which we've been looking at this evening. In Revelation 13, the beast is described as having in its head the names of blasphemy. Here in chapter 14 and verse 1, I looked and lo, a lamb upon the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. And as we said earlier in verse 4, these are they which are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. They follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. They then are the constituents of the true bride of Christ, who will be arrayed in white in that day to which we look, when Christ will come to set up the kingdom. Chapter 14 sets out the fall of Babylon, but the love of God in giving opportunity for those in the earth to repent. As verse 6 talks about that gospel which is going to be preached. I saw an angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. And so the world has the opportunity to accept the rule of Christ, or it will suffer destruction and judgment, as described in the rest of the chapter. What a wonderful thing it is, brothers and sisters, to be able to see these things and to know that we are able to look with confidence to the day when the Lord Jesus Christ will come. That we are in that time when he will return to rule from Mount Zion, when the kingdoms of this world will be brought down, the kingdom of men will be destroyed, these beast systems will be a thing of the past, and those who are with Christ in that day will be seen to be those faithful who will be there in the kingdom, allowing that gospel message to go forth in the kingdom age and bring about that time when the earth will be filled with God's glory as the waters cover the sea. Thank you.